Alors, je suis très heureux d'accueillir John Parkington, qui nous vient d'Afrique du Sud et qui a énormément travaillé sur ces sites du Middle Stone Age d'Afrique du Sud, en particulier d'un site dont je vois qu'il a ici présenté un élément où on trouve ces premières représentations symboliques. Et John va nous parler de cette émergence des comportements modernes dans cette région du monde.
Thank you. I want to start by thanking Jean-Jacques and the Collège de France for inviting me to come and talk here. I'm sorry I'm not speaking in French. Well, I'm not sorry I'm not speaking in French. It would be terrible if I did that, but I am going to speak in English. And I'm going to talk about... I'm still very excited about what you were saying just now, and there are various places where what I'm going to say and what you were saying, you know, will fit very well together. I'm going to talk about behavioral modernity, and it's quite difficult to define anatomical modernity, but what we would mean by that, I presume, is skeletal remains from the past that we could lose in the variability of modern skeletal material. That's not my field, I'm an archaeologist. Behavioral modernity, what would we mean by that? Well, I think what we, it's a difficult concept and it's not perfect. What we would mean, I think, is when in the past did hunter-gatherer people start behaving like hunter-gatherers of the present and the recent past? We've got a very good record of hunter-gatherer people in tropical forests, in the Arctic, in various deserts. And there's a kind of coherence about the way hunter-gatherers approach the world and what they do. And so what I mean by the appearance of this kind of behavioral modernity is when did hunter-gatherers in the past start to behave like that? When does their behavior become, as it were, lost in the variability of modern hunter-gatherer behavior? I've chosen to do this by thinking of this as a kind of illness, if you like. When did this illness come about? Although, when did things go wrong? Or one might say, when did things go right, as it were? What are the symptoms that people began to behave this way? The patient is the archaeological record. The patient is the archaeological record that we've managed to recover from a series of excavations. And so what I'm asking is, when in that record do these symptoms of modernity appear? I'm not making any commitment about the order in which they appear, nor about how suddenly or how gradually they appear. I do have some feelings about that, and Southern African evidence is very informative in that regard. But I'm not really talking about that. I'm talking about how do we recognize these symptoms and diagnose the patient. The problem is the patient is very unreliable. You've got he or she has a terrible memory and tends not always to tell the truth. So it's quite difficult to do this diagnosis and to arrive at a narrative of how these things came about. But that's the issue. And the problems are, first of all, that archaeological record is very patchy. The memory, if you like, is very patchy. It comes and goes. And it also deals a lot in proxies. It often doesn't tell us the particular things we would like to know. It tells us something else, which we have to make mean what we would like to know. So we often, we don't excavate language, for instance. And lots of things that we can only try and recover by excavating the material evidence and then, if you like, interrogating it so that it can tell us about the things that we would really like to know and that we'd really like to dig up if we could. So here are my list of symptoms, and there's some similarity with the things that you have just heard about now from Jean-Jacques. And right in the middle, Right in the middle is a cave. It's not a grot, it's more an abri, it's a very large abri. Because I want to talk about this first, because if we as archaeologists in southern Africa want to find this evidence, we want to find the earliest modern people and their behavior, we go and look in caves. That's where the evidence is. Now, and so in that time period from about 150,000 years ago, people began to more regularly occupy these caves and rock shelters. They began to prefer rocky enclaves where there are caves or overhangs. Now, I'm not saying that they didn't do that before, and I'm not saying that they always did that afterwards. But there is a very distinct shift in the places that people appear to be preferring, if you like, during that time period. And I'm not sure whether this is one of the symptoms or whether it is something that is confusing our recognition of those symptoms. Because as soon as people do start to take themselves into these caves and to behave and leave the debris into those caves, they automatically make it much more visible to us. And so this is a very important feature that we'll have to try and pull apart. It may be that there is something in this increased preference for caves, which is of interest to us as the doctor looking at the patient, but it certainly is going to impact on the survival of those symptoms and the survival of that evidence that we're looking for. So we have to be careful about this. This, by the way, is a cave in the southwestern part of South Africa that we've been excavating for about nearly 20 years with our colleagues from the University of Bordeaux. We're taking a break at the moment, but maybe we'll go back and excavate it again. The second symptom, when you get near the bottom of these caves, as soon as you start looking at the evidence, if the caves are close enough to the present, to the contemporary shoreline, there will be shell in them. There will be shellfish. So, at the deepest part of these caves, there will be shell middens, what we call shell middens. These are abundant shells. It's not isolated pieces of shell. It's not isolated shells. It is abundant shell. The dominant matrix, if you like, in the stratigraphic layers are the remains of shellfish that people have brought back to the cave, eaten, and thrown away. Now, this is very important, but what we might wonder is, before people were regularly coming and doing this in caves, had they been doing it for any amount of time in open sites along the riverbanks, along the shoreline, had they been accumulating shellfish there? And we simply don't find it because it's not surviving as well. The baboons on the Cape Peninsula eat shellfish. But what they do is they eat as they go. They pick and eat and throw away. They never take things back to a central place. So the key thing about... So now we're beginning to see that there is some connection here. What we are seeing and what is appearing in the archaeological record at about 170,000 years ago is the regular visiting of the intertidal rocky shores, the collection of shellfish. Of course, some of them may have been eaten there, but some of them were taken back to the cave. It could be 3 or 4 kilometres away. It could be 5 kilometres away. It's not usually more than that. And you've got to ask yourself, why are they not eating them on the spot and throwing the shells away? What is it that's causing them to take those shellfish back to some central place? And I'll come back to that, because I believe that there are some social issues here that are being revealed by this part of the archaeological record. The next symptom that I want to talk about, and it's also very difficult, is that, again, in these caves and rock shelters, there are fireplaces. I'm not talking about burnt patches. I'm not talking about patches of ash. I'm talking about very clearly defined fireplaces, which are the nodal points of behavior. People are organizing their domestic life around these fireplaces in these caves and rock shelters. Now again, we can find those traces in the caves because the preservation is very good, and we can excavate those sites and we can map what's going on around them, fine. But again, we have the problem of when we step back before 180,000 years, before we've really got virtually any occupation of caves at all, but there are some, then we don't see that. Is this the evidence of absence or the absence of evidence? This is a huge problem for all archaeologists, you know. When can we be sure that something wasn't there and then it is there? Because as the doctor looking at the patient, we're trying to understand the sequence of events and diagnose this illness of modernity. I'll come back to these fireplaces as well later. So you can see the first series of symptoms are behavioural. They're about the kind of place you prefer to go. They're about what you do in those places. And they're about the fact that you're bringing something along with you to those places. There's something social here that appears to be changing. Now, whenever alongside these features, whenever you find fragments of human remains, they're modern. Jean-Jacques showed this mandible from Classes Rivermouth. It's perfectly modern. If we had all of your mandibles and we popped that one in, we would lose it in there. It's a perfectly modern. And all the fragments of human bone, we don't get burials. There is one which we could talk about at Border Cave. I'm not so sure how old that is. But if we leave that one aside for the moment, there are no burials here. But there are human remains. They're fragments of bone that are scattered in there amongst the animal bones. However, they're all modern. This is a piece of frontal and a mandible. Most of these caves don't have a lot of human remains, probably because people are not burying. But they do have human remains. They are fragmentary and they're modern. So the people who are doing these things are modern. Now, I can't come to Paris without talking about stone tools, obviously. I was, as an undergraduate, I was raised on French Paleolithic archaeology. It's what you have to do. The stone artifacts that are associated with these fireplaces, with these shell middens in these caves, are really interesting. And they include a lot of very innovative, but also precocious behaviours. Innovative in that we haven't seen them before. Precocious in that they're showing us the way things are going to go. The same is true, of course, of these behavioural things. But what we have in these caves is beautiful soft hammer struck blades. Very, very carefully flaked, prepared cores from which these beautiful ribbon-like blades are struck with very tiny platforms, very diffuse bulbs, and so on. Jean-Jacques showed some of these very beautiful bifacially flaked leaf points. Now, we know from looking at some of these stone artifacts that the stone toolmakers are, in fact, they've understood that if they put the stone in the fire and heat it, they will improve its flaking characteristics. And you can see from the way the flaking procedure, the chaîne opératoire, intersects with the heating evidence, we can see that this is not accidental. This is not pieces of stone falling into the fire and then somebody saying, oh my goodness, this looks good, you know. No, this is chemistry. This is people who understood what they were doing and were systematically heating stone so that they could flake it better. They were very conscious of which kinds of stone to look for, and in this period from about 150,000 years on, they were being quite selective about which stone they were using. And this is not like France with your flint. We have no flint. Silex. We don't. We have stone that will flake in the same way as flint does, but it's patchy and it's distributed across the landscape in in a rather different kind of way. And the people are choosing to select particular kinds of stone. They're heating it so it'll flake better. They are making mastics, gums, so that they can stick the stone tool in the end of a shaft. More chemistry, because these mastics have quite complex recipes, which include ochre, iron oxide powder that they're putting into that recipe. So the level of understanding of stone tool flaking and hafting is extremely developed. And it's things that we haven't seen before. But it's things that from then on are going to dominate, obviously, the stone tool record. There are some archaeologists in southern Africa who believe that some of these stone artifacts were in fact mounted in arrows and that people had the bow and arrow. I'm personally not a believer in that, but they're my friends, so I only say that when I'm a long way away. Nevertheless, there are a cluster of behavioural traits associated with stone tool making and stone tool use that are very advanced that tell us that things were happening. There is a lot of ochre, iron oxide, which when it weathers is very powdery and chalky, and you can grind it and get the powder, and then you can mix the powder to make paint. Now, we know later on in southern Africa, and of course in France as well, people were using this to paint on the walls of caves. We have no suggestion that at 90 or 100,000 years ago people were painting on the walls of caves. They may have been painting on themselves. They may actually have been using this powder for something other than paint. Right? They were certainly putting it in the recipe to make the mastic that was sticking the stone artifact onto the wooden shaft. And they may have been using it in other ways as well. There's quite a substantial debate about what the preparation of ochre was for. Most of it consists of irregular pieces of ochre that are beveled and striated from being ground on a piece of quartzite to get the powder. But as Jean-Jacques showed, there are a few pieces, a small number of pieces, perhaps a dozen in total from various sites in southern Africa, where there does seem to be some marking on the ochre. This is a very elaborate piece of marking. It's a lattice grid. It's not something that could have happened by accident, and it doesn't appear to be something that is functional. So it's tempting to call it decorated, but I don't like that word because it seems to trivialize it a little bit. It's intentional marking, right? But we've got a much better example, actually, than that. And this is material that we excavated from this site here, this piece here, and this piece here. We've got about 450 pieces. Jean-Philippe Rigaud, Pierre-Jean Texier, Guillaume Poraz, and I don't know if Christine Werner is... Christine is there. Christine was there. Hello. These are pieces of very, very clearly marked ostrich eggshell, and it's equally clear that they were once part of ostrich eggshell water containers. Ostrich egg's a big thing like this. You perforate it and you can store and transport water in them. And the perforation by which you get the egg out and get the water in is pretty clear. This is an example of it here. And you can see this one actually has a very nice crosshatch motif. I'm going to talk about these again later. But the point is, these are, and you mentioned this, you know, in the case of the ochre, but I think that the ostrich eggshell is a much better example to talk about this than the ochre, because this is a very clear object. It's an object which has a very clear function, and I'll come back to this again later, it's concrete. This is what I mean by a proxy. It's concrete evidence that people could think about tomorrow and yesterday because they're transporting in time and in space. They're storing. They're putting there for another time. And they're moving it around. It's a little bit like the shellfish that are coming from the shoreline into the cave. This is water that's coming from somewhere in this storage container, and it's going to the cave. All of our pieces are broken. We're not fortunate enough to find complete eggs. But eggs like this are still being used in the Kalahari. It's rather like the kind of genetic continuity that Jean-Jacques was talking about that gets you all the way from Kalahari populations right back to 150,000 years ago. Here's a tradition of making and using ostrich eggs as water containers that has a very long history. Of course, I'm assuming, here's archaeology happening again, I'm assuming that they're putting water in there. We don't have any water in there, we don't even have any whole ones. So I'm really using the tradition as it survives in the Kalahari, and as we've got it from here on, as support for that interpretation. Okay. So what we're talking about here is people doing a whole lot of stuff with stone, using a lot of ochre, visiting these rocky areas, collecting shellfish, lighting fires. These are not just changes in behavior that we see in the archaeological record. They are the changes in behavior that are going to last. It's not a shift somewhere, it's a shift to where things are going to go. The rest of the archaeological record in southern Africa looks more or less like this. This is what people, once they start to do, continue to do until 350 years ago when colonialism effectively destroyed the Stone Age sequence. So those are the symptoms. If I were to sum them up, what I'd say is this. People began to, perhaps preferentially isn't quite the right word, but they began to become much more interested in rocky areas and caves and rock shelters. They began to eat shellfish more frequently and left the debris in recognizable middens, which are not in the place where they've collected the shellfish from the shore. They're being transported. They began to organize domestic spaces around features such as hearths. But in some of the other sites, not I don't think so much in the cave that we were excavating, but in some of the other caves in southern Africa, there are patches of bedding that people were sleeping on. So they are beginning to utilize the domestic potential of these caves, like people subsequently did for another 100,000 years. They began to, technologically, they began to become very capable at flaking stone, and they began to make the kinds of artifacts in the kinds of ways that we hadn't seen previously. And you see, some of these things we should be able to find outside the caves. The stone things we should find. The stone preserves whether it's in a cave or not. But some of these things preserve better in the caves, and so we have to be a little bit cautious about whether we're actually seeing the first evidence of those things or we're just finding the first evidence that happens to have survived in our record. That's what worries us, obviously. They're beginning to mark a range of objects. They're marking objects like these ostrich eggs. They're marking themselves by wearing beads, and they're marking places that they're living in by lighting those fires and putting the bedding, and no doubt some other things that they're doing as well in those caves. There's a lot of marking going on. There's a lot of distinguishing going on. This is not just an egg. I mean, we would all be very hard put to distinguish one ostrich egg from another. They look very similar. Once they've got those markings on, they're not any old egg. They're your egg or your egg. This is what you were suggesting earlier. These may well be signs of personal ownership, or they may be signs of group ownership, right? It's theoretically conceivable that they are sell-by dates. Don't drink this water after whatever. I don't think so. They are social. They're conveying social information, as the people are, by wearing particular kinds of beads and so on. And I'm going to come back to this social significance a bit later. And they're beginning to transform these little gastropods, these little... by the way, I was talking to somebody, Danny Bar-Yosef, the other day, about... there are not only these little gastropods clearly intentionally perforated to be strung as beads, not only in southern Africa and in North Africa, but also in the Near East, in Israel. There are. So they may even be older in Israel than they are in southern Africa and in Morocco. And I just want to take this as an opportunity to say something about what you were saying. We are a long way from being able to write a narrative about this. If I'm giving the impression that we've got a good narrative, then I'm just being unusually eloquent, because we don't. There are lots of things. The distances between some of these places that Jean-Jacques was talking about are enormous. There's a huge amount that we don't understand about these patterns that are appearing in the archaeological record. And they're beginning to develop complex recipes for mastics. In other words, they understood the resins and the glues and the exudates that were coming out of plants. They were collecting those things and they were mixing them in recipes with other things so that they could use them to stick their stone tooltip onto a wooden shaft. Now, no doubt they were doing a whole lot of other things as well that we would really like to know, but we don't have evidence from. When does this start to manifest? Well, it starts to manifest about 160,000 years ago. 160,000 years ago, we have the first signs of regular shell middens stratified in caves being brought there by modern people and fireplaces. Some of which may go back before. Now, my understanding of this, that it's about the organization of space. It's about the organization of domestic space, seasonal space as people move around between different locations, and regional space as people learn how to pack themselves into these different spaces and to communicate with others as well as your own group about how these spaces are going to be organized. If you're going to move around from one place to another, then you've got to be sure that where you're going next week, those nasty people over there don't think that they're also going there, because remember what happened last time, right? You know. So it's about organizing, it's about planning, it's about the social manipulation of space and people within it. It's about organizing access to resources, about establishing relationships to particular places. I think the notion of place, not just a space, but a place that's home, that's ours, whatever. I think these kinds of notions, place and landscape, were probably being defined in a particular way at this time. This is the social brain. I'm following here a whole series of anthropologists and neuroscientists, psychologists, who have argued that the reason for increased intellect, for consciousness, is social. It's not so that we could strike off better stone blades. It's not about that. It's about dealing with an increasing size of fellows. Robin Dunbar has, and lots of people actually, have spent some time looking at the relationship between the increased brain size, but particularly the cortex size, and the social group in which that primate lives. And there's a very good correlation. As you go from primates who operate in very small groups to primates who operate in very large groups, that cortex gets bigger. And it's because you need to store such a lot of information. You need to know who's who. You need to know what's happening between individuals and between individuals and you. That's what's driving this. And of course, the bridge between the physical evolution that Jean-Jacques is talking about and the kind of behavioral, artifactual, technological, and social evolution that we archaeologists are interested in, the bridge there is the brain. That's the piece of equipment that's doing the job. I just want to, a couple of, of my kind of, I don't stay awake at night, so I can't say that these things keep me awake at night, but if I was the kind of person who would stay awake at night, these are the things that would keep me awake. How reliable is the narrative? Remember, it's very patchy. And we're often dealing, we're trying to make something mean something other than what it is. It is a piece of ostrich eggshell with some markings on it. And I can tell you that my colleagues have told me all kinds of things about these pieces of ostrich egg, which I don't believe. But I am making an inference when I tell you that they are fragments of ostrich eggshell water bottles, and that I can use that to say something even more interesting, hopefully, about what people were doing. There are changes in the framework as well in the content, and that's the shift to cave. That's really important. It's not, what we're looking at here is not just changes in the content that we have available. We're looking at changes in the container that makes it available. And we've really got to worry about that, and I'll come back to that later. And when are we looking at the evidence of absence? Were they not doing something back there, or were they doing that kind of thing, but we just don't happen to have the evidence that survives to tell us about it. And in what order do these symptoms occur? Okay. Now, I apologize for straying into your area here, but what is it that makes a hominin into a human? Well, you had a nice long list there of characteristics of Homo sapiens, but I think the thing that really characterizes Homo sapiens is the size of the brain. Not so much the size of the brain, but the connectivity of the brain. So that, for instance, if we plot a log of brain weight against body weight, we get a pretty good relationship between mammals. But some mammals are deviating from that line more than others. The way to read this is that each of these triangles is a particular species. This is called... So the more you deviate from the line, the more extra brain you appear to have given your body weight, given the relatively good, but not perfect, relationship between brain weight and body weight. If you're on this side of the line, you're very unfortunate. You've got rather less brain than your body weight would have predicted. But if you're on that line, that side of the line, you've got rather more brain than your body weight would have predicted. And we can see, because we've got the primates here, we can see that primates for tens of millions of years have been evolving in the direction of putting attention into brain weight. Now, I wouldn't be talking about brain weight if we could measure connectivity in the record, but we can't, as far as I know. So it's another proxy. We use brain size as a proxy measure of connectivity. And this is us out here. And these species that are near us are whales and dolphins. Okay. So we have been embarked for about 60 million years, probably, on the quest for more processing power. Okay. And we're doing pretty well. Now, but the question is, where in recent human evolution was this most marked? Well, if you look at Australopithecine species or early Homo species, they're not really very much more encephalized than the chimpanzee. I suppose if we didn't have us up here, we would think this is rather fantastic progress, you know. But if you look at the whole sequence right through, then it's clear that most of the encephalization gains have happened in the last 500,000 years, maybe even more recently. Look, we have a terrible fossil human record. Terrible. I might be getting into trouble here. It is awful. It's fragmentary, you know. How many brains with associated body weight do we actually have in the Pleistocene so that we could calculate an encephalization quotient? Very few. Anyway, we carry on. So I'm interested in what's happened recently. And you can see where I'm going here. I'm interested in the possibility that some of these things that happened, some of these behavioral characteristics that happened in the emergence of our species and the emergence of modern behavior may be tied to this. For a long time, paleoanthropologists assumed that the way you got... You see, your brain's very expensive. It takes about 20% of your energy. And in utero, it takes 60 or 70%. It's a very, very expensive piece of equipment. How can we afford it, right? And for a long time, paleoanthropologists talked about improving the quality of diet, by which they mostly meant shifting to meat eating. But I think there's something more specific than meat that's involved here, because your brains and mine are 60% lipid, okay? On every one of our synaptic junctions, there is a particular long-chain polyunsaturated fatty acid, this stuff here, DHA. And on every one of your retinal receptors, there is that same long-chain fatty acid. They're part of the omega-3 chain. You can't make this in your body, which is a shorter chain. You have to eat it. And you're not very good at elongating it in your body to make the longer chain version that your body needs. As soon as your body detects this, it shunts it straight to the central nervous system and the brain. It doesn't waste that kind of stuff making a bit of muscle or anything like that. No. It's brain, right? Now, you could argue that brains need lots of things, and I know that's true. Brains do. But they definitely need substantial supplies of the long-chain derivatives of the omega-3 chain and the omega-6 chain. And we're not good at manufacturing it. And, of course, women, and I'll come back to women, are constantly using it up because the fetus is not only raiding the bones of calcium, it's raiding the brain of these long-chain fatty acids. So women go through cycles of losing and having to remanufacture. And it really doesn't matter what men eat in terms of evolution. So we began to be very interested, at least I began to be very interested in the fact that a lot of this evidence that I've been describing, a lot of these symptoms that I've been describing, are appearing along with shellfish in the archaeological record of southern Africa. And there are no shell middens anywhere in the world as early as this. None. Of course, many parts of the world at 160,000, 170,000 years ago were not occupied yet. There was nobody in America, nobody in Australia, but there were people in Europe, and as far as I understand, shellfish gathering came a little bit later. But there may be a lot of parallels between what was happening in North Africa and the Mediterranean and Southern Africa. I live in Cape Town, which is a Mediterranean climate, a Mediterranean ecosystem, like Morocco and the Mediterranean. And it seems to me very... I'm always suspicious of coincidences. It seems to me very interesting that some of these developments are happening at the northern and southern tips of Africa, but we'll have to see. So, we've got a bit of a narrative here. We could make a narrative. We could say, and I'm not going to talk about paleo environments, but we could say that with that aridity that you see in North Africa in the Sahara, it's paralleled in southern Africa. There were long periods of time, 60 or 70,000 years, when the interior of southern Africa was incredibly dry, and populations would have been funneled around the coastline. Of course, the sea level was a bit lower, so the coastline was a little bit further. There was a little bit more of Africa down in the south. So we could say that populations in those kinds of areas, as it were, recognizing the advantages of integrating the terrestrial plant remains that we know they were eating because we excavate them, and the marine fat and protein remains, began this process of utilizing more regularly shellfish. The women therefore provided themselves, I'm not saying they knew that this was intentional, but they would accidentally have been providing themselves with precisely the rich nutrients that you need in order to build a bigger brain. And the site we're excavating with colleagues from, Paris and Bordeaux is the site here of Diepkloof. But there are many other sites, and I'm not going to fight this battle here, but there is a big debate as to, well, what about all the sites that are in here? There are thousands of Middle Stone Age sites in the interior. However, the assemblages that we're interested in, the ones that Jean-Jacques pointed out, the ones that we call Still Bay with the bifacial points, or Howison's Port with the small backed segments, these are the later part of the Middle Stone Age. And there are almost none in here of those kinds of sites. So what was happening may have begun to happen before the later part of the Middle Stone Age, but it certainly accelerated in the later part of the Middle Stone Age after about 120,000 years ago. And it happening in many of these cases. I will just... Again, we've got the evidence of absence versus absence of evidence problem. Why are we seeing all this exciting stuff in Southern Africa? Is it because Southern Africa has a very strong research record, and so we've done more excavations, we've given ourselves a better chance of finding the evidence, and perhaps that doesn't happen elsewhere? Is it because the preservational characteristics of Southern Africa are very good, but as you said earlier, you go to the tropical forest, preservation is very, very poor. So we're constantly trying to distinguish the evidence of absence from the absence of evidence. Okay. But I would say at the moment there is overwhelming evidence, particularly around the coastlines of Southern Africa, but possibly in the whole of Southern Africa, for early signs of innovation and precocious behavior. And it's a cluster of behavioral and physical, technological and social things. I'm just going to digress a bit to try and make a point about this shift in preference of where to live. We recently got on, there's a dam here, this is in the Western Cape, this is a small river valley in the Western Cape, and they recently decided to raise the wall of the dam, and so they're going to flood both sides of this river. And we got the opportunity to go and have a look ahead of the flooding. And we were they gave us some money, and we were able to map all the iconic artifacts. We didn't map sites, we mapped iconic artifacts, artifacts where we were pretty sure we knew where they fitted in the sequence. This is a map of what you have in the Saint-Achille, in the Somme Valley, or in the Thames Valley in Europe. Large, bifacially flaked, we would call hand axe, bifas, or cleavers. And this is the distribution of them. And they are very, very, apart from one or two isolated examples, they're all around the banks of that river. Why? Well, if you're going to make a hand axe this big, you need a boulder this big. You don't carry four or five of them around in your bag in case you need to use them. You are tethered to your raw material. You can't... it's difficult for you to move away from those raw materials because you can't transport them and transform them into artifacts when the need arises. That's where the artifacts before 180,000 years are. This is where they are after 180,000 years. People are freed from their raw material. They can make another kind of decision as to where they want to be. And they're going away. There are a few sites still around there, but that's where there are caves and rock shelters. So the place where a cave is and the place where your raw material is effectively the same place in some cases. But there are many more caves and rock shelters in these little rocky areas, and people are going there. Now, this is very speculative, but I think there is something really different between a cave there and a scatter of raw material that's effectively all along the banks of this river. This is much more specific. This is a place that needs a name, right? This is a place that can be the focal point of an arrangement. This is a place that you need to defend against those other nasties who might also have their eyes on it. These are the nodal points of that organization of space on the landscape. But what's important about it is if we now, this is the later Stone Age, this is the last 10,000 years. When people moved to those caves and rock shelters, that's where they stayed for the next 80 or 90,000 years. When you excavate in these caves, you are finding the later Stone Age on the top, and if you go down, you're finding the Middle Stone Age, and particularly the later Middle Stone Age, from about 150,000 years, you're finding that below. And I think what we need to be able to do is to wrestle more information about that. Because, of course, if you think about the ostrich eggshell water container, for instance, it's all very well living there, but there's no water there necessarily. Plenty of water here. Well, it's a dam, so there's more water there now than there used to be, but that used to be where the water was. So you are freed from the raw material in two ways. First of all, because your artifacts are getting smaller and you're mounting them in shafts. So you can take a couple of blocks like this in your bag, and you can turn that into 30 or 40 or 50 blades or flakes to make the artifacts you need when you need them, yes? But you can also go there because you can take the water with you. And here's a whole list of caves that are being excavated at the moment, or were excavated fairly recently. So Deep Cliff is where we've been digging. But if you dig in these caves, you go down through the later Stone Age, you will find some of the later part of the Middle Stone Age, then you'll bottom out. It's very rare. There are a few, I would have to mention these, Montague Cave, Van der Werck Cave, and these two caves up in the Transvaal. There are a few caves that will go back further than that, but by and large, if you dig down there, when you get to the bottom, you'll be at 120,000 or 135,000 or 150,000. You'll not be at 250,000 by and large, right? Now, this is not because the caves only appeared at 180, 120,000 years ago. These caves were around for hundreds of thousands of years before they were occupied by people. They were not considered the place you went and did things. They were ignored, by and large. My guess is, but I can't really demonstrate this, is that these exceptions will turn out to be places where the criteria of raw material and water probably coincides with the criteria of shelter and home. That's what I'm guessing, but I may be wrong. And these are, this is Deep Cliff up here. And this is De Kelders, which is a site nearer to the Cape. And these are typical examples of this. But these are sites all over southern Africa. They're all around the coastline. And they're even some to some extent into the interior. And when you get into those caves, you find shells. Of course, you don't find them in all of the caves. Some of the caves are simply too far away. At Deep Kloof, we have got some shell, but at Deep Kloof, even with the lowering and rising of sea level and the moving back and forth of the shoreline, Deep Kloof has never been more than about less than about 17 or 20 kilometers from the coast. So we don't get big shell middens in there, but we do get shells. But at De Kelders, at Pinnacle Point, at Blombos, and some new sites further east, if the coastline is close enough at 120, 140, 150,000 years, they were bringing shells back and eating them. Fireplaces, this is Classes River Mouth that Jean-Jacques mentioned, very, very significant site. All of this is shell midden, 22 meters of shell midden. You know, the sea's right here, so the shells came back and they were living in one or two caves, and then they were just living in front of... It's not... These people are not necessarily living in the caves permanently. They're not troglodytes. They like to live in front of the caves. They're scraping their skins. They're making their beads. They're doing whatever out there in the front of the cave. They like the rocky area. They like to be able to retreat to the cave, but they're not living permanently in the cave. And if you look at the stratigraphy of this site, beautiful fireplaces with the stratigraphy of a hearth, which is absolutely characteristic. Nice little charcoal lining at the bottom and then ashy patch delimited and so on. And in some cases, this is the mayor of Les Aisies de Taillac from the Dordogne. He came to visit us, which was very nice of him. And we went to visit him, which is also very nice. But Cedric, my colleague, is showing them that some of the fireplaces and other features of the cave. This is Cedric again, just exposing a beautiful little hearth with charcoal. We've collected a lot of the charcoal from there to identify the plants, but it's very clear that this was this is an artifact to organize one's domestic behavior. If you go to the Kalahari today and you look at the way the San hunter-gatherers in the Kalahari operate, it's all about fireplaces. Every nuclear family has a fireplace and they have a little windbreak. And you can measure the distance between the fireplace and the back of the windbreak. It's absolutely standard. Sometimes they don't bother much with a windbreak. They just put a couple of bushes there. But there's got to be some symbolic indication of where that nuclear family's windbreak and hearth was. It's the key to understanding the social organization and the social distribution of those hunter-gatherer people. And it looks as though it's here. And this is another fireplace from Sibudu, a little bit further to the northeast. And Lynn Wadley, who's the archaeologist excavating here, found all this ochre. This is a processing fire. This is a place where those recipes were processed, where the ochre was ground, the recipes were mixed, and presumably old artifacts were taken out of their mastic and thrown away, and a new artifact was put in place and then probably taken away from the fire where the mastic cools and hardens. And here are our pieces of ostrich egg. Now, a modern ostrich egg is a very white, creamy kind of white color. These have been in and around fires for 60 or 70,000 years, but they're clearly very intentionally marked. The most frequent kind of marking is a kind of railway line pattern, whereby two parallel lines are incised and then some sleepers, if to take the railway line analog, are put on them. In this case of this piece, there's one there, one here, and one here. In some cases, there's only one. Some cases, there may be two or three. Now, the point about this motif is that it's pretty standardized. The key thing to having some marking that symbolizes something, that means something, is that you obey the rules of meaning. You don't do something that's off the wall because then people can't read it. So Pierre-Jean Texier has studied this, and in fact, here's his diagram. It seems to be always the case that the railway lines in red are done first, and then the crosshatched lines. Now, you have a certain amount of flexibility within this system. You can alter the distance between the railway lines. You can alter the distance between the lines going across the railway line. This is a language that you can read and you can play with, but there are limits to what you can do because then it becomes unintelligible and it's not serving its purpose. It's really, and of course, to some extent, Pierre-Jean has been fitting these together. To some extent, we can tell where on the egg they're making these bands. We've had quite a lot of opposition to this. In fact, in the last 2 months, I won't mention any very famous paleoanthropologist names, but there are people who have said to us that these pieces probably fell down from the later Stone Age above. You know, they're just kind of, they don't really belong there because they're 80,000 years old or 70,000 years old. That's too old for some people's model of what was happening. It's nonsense, I'm afraid, and they're friends of mine, but it's really nonsense. These are in place. The stratigraphy of Diepkloof is very good. You'd have to postulate four or five completely unlikely sequential events to get these things to filter down. First of all, we don't have any marked ostrich eggshell in the later Stone Age at this site. Secondly, they'd have to percolate their way right down through 10 stratigraphic units and then stop in one and then not go any further. I mean, it's absolutely ludicrous. No, these belong. They're important. And they are they're almost a material reflection of the kinds of modern behavior which many scientists have described. That's what a modern egg, perforated egg, that you might use in that way. So this is about memory. This is about remembering places and going back and back to places. I think if we could go, if we were fortunate enough to be able to go to those early sites along the river valleys and understand them better, I don't think they are anything like the same kinds of places as the later sites. We just put a green triangle for this and a red dot for that, but I don't think they're the same kinds of places. But it's very hard to. I mean, we have to find ways of, you know, unpicking that in the archaeological record. It's about these kinds of things. It's about place and social landscape. And I want to come back to that social point. This is kind of like my current favorite reading, so I apologize for kind of burdening you with it. But there are a whole series of people who've said very interesting things about what neurological modernity is, if you like. And it goes right back to somebody like Nick Humphrey, who talked about the social function of intellect. He's a psychologist. And it developed through a number of psychologists and anthropologists and primatologists talking about Machiavellian intelligence, the capacity to deceive. You know, primates are not very good at deception. They're not very good at pointing. We're pretty good at deception. I may be deceiving you now. Perhaps not. Peter Gardenfors, Swedish philosopher, talked about an inner world and detached representations, the capacity to talk about something that isn't actually there. It's not a cued representation. It's not cued by something I can see, something that's here. It's a detached representation. It's tomorrow, if you like, or it's something about yesterday. As I say, Robin Dunbar's developed this. Language is the kind of elephant in the room here, because Hockett, many years ago, talked about referential displacement, in other words, the capacity to talk about something that isn't there, the capacity to refer to yesterday or tomorrow, or there as well as here, then as well as now. I read yesterday on the plane coming over, we're always in the here and now, but we can talk about the then and the there, and we can also talk about the other. And in fact, we're so good that we can talk about things that don't exist at all. And so the whole notion of shamanism, which is very popular among some archaeologists, it's probably an outgrowth of this. But Megan Beisler is an American anthropologist. She said this. I was reading her book, Women Like Meat, a fantastic book. I was reading it for another reason. I wanted to know what the San people thought about elephants, because we're writing a book on elephant paintings. And she said their metaphor has a multiplier effect on experience. Oh, gee, I had to put the book down and sit and have a glass of water. So what she's saying there is that metaphor, narrative, storytelling. She was making a case for expressive culture not being just peripheral and, you know, irrelevant, but being evolutionarily significant. Metaphor, the capacity for one thing not just to stand for one other thing, but to stand for a lot of other things. It has a multiplier effect on experience. And there's quite a bit on the literature about the ratchet effect and those kinds of things. And I think this is really very important. And then finally, David Horobin, who's unfortunately no longer with us, he was a lipidologist, a British lipidologist. And Jonathan Burns, who's a South African psychologist, have talked about schizophrenia as unintended consequences of the emergence of modernity. If modernity is this increased wired, connected capacity, then when it goes wrong, You have people who can't do these social things, who can't manage these memory and these interpersonal relations and can't manage them. Anyway, those are interesting things. What do we need to do? Well, there's two things here. First, we've got to try and reuse old observations. We're not going to get much of a better or a different archaeological record, but we're going to have to try and make it say some things. And of course, it is going to get a bit better because it's going to get denser. We're going to dig more sites. We're going to see more connections in time and space, and that's going to be very useful. And hopefully, we'll get a better coverage of Africa. That would, you know, in terms of what you were saying, would be absolutely crucial. Because otherwise, we have a tendency to invent TV soapy kind of narratives. I mean, we're talking here about tens of thousands of years, possibly 100,000 years. It's not a family to which this happens, except in the sense that we're all one family. We need a lot more evidence, and we need to make older evidence tell us things that it's not previously told us. But most importantly, we need to know what happened before all these things. I'm talking about us in southern Africa. We need to know what was happening at 200,000, 250,000 years. What was 180,000 years like, let's say, compared with 120,000 and 80,000? What is the sequence of events? When were there not these things? And why were there not these things? Is it just taphonomic? Is it just the luck of the archaeological draw? Or can we build real behavioral narratives into these things? I think that's where we're going. You know, there's a lot of work in southern Africa now. So just to get back to your Garden of Eden. Yeah, there was a Garden of Eden, but it wasn't a garden. It was a beach, you know. However, women, Eve, did bring a fruit from the tree of knowledge to Adam, but it wasn't an apple, it was a limpet. Thank you.